Thank you so much for coming to Practice Zen today. Today's Teisho is on case 43 in the Pien Lu, the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 43 is Tozan's No Cold or Heat. Engo's Introduction. The words which command the universe are obeyed throughout the ages. The spirit able to quell the tiger amazes even thousands of the holy ones. His words are matchless. His spirit prevails everywhere. If you want to go through with your advanced training, you must enter the great master's forge. Tell me, who could ever show such a spirit? See the following. Main subject. A monk said to Tozan, "Cold and heat descend upon us. How can we avoid them?" Tozan said, "Why don't you go where there is no cold or heat?" The monk said, "Where's the place where there is no cold or heat?" Tozan said, "When it's cold, let the cold kill you. When it's hot, let the heat kill you." Secho's verse, a helping hand, but still a thousand fathom cliff. Sho and hen, no arbitrary distinction here. The ancient emerald palace shines in the bright moonlight. Clever Kanro climbs the steps and finds it empty. So, some of you may be aware that we have had two really terrific storms in the last week. So last 7-day, 8-day period. So Friday night we had a terrific windstorm, and it was so powerful that it knocked out all the electricity in all the power in our neighborhood. And it pulled down many trees in the town where I lived. It was pretty appalling. And for three days, we had no heat and no electricity. And this was true for many people in our town, Plainfield. And then Tuesday, PSE&G got the power back on, and that was lovely for 2 days. And then on Wednesday, we had a tremendous snowstorm, and the snow was very wet and heavy. And again, it really brought down many trees, branches, and wires. And so we're still without electricity again and light, you know. So this has happened before to us. It may not have happened in your town this time. And if it hasn't, I was talking to somebody from Highland Park, and a person from Highland Park said, "Yeah, we got a little wind, not too much of a problem." On the other hand, friends of mine from other parts of New Jersey just tell horror stories. If you have been on Rutgers campus recently, and you've been down on College Avenue, if you go to the quad between Van Dyke Hall and Murray Hall, there are all of these old elm trees that are 100 years old. And I fear that they're all going to have to be taken down. They're all been broken up as though by a big hand in the sky. Just came down and smashed up all these beautiful old elms, which are really quite rare. Very few elms live to be that old now because of a disease. So, you know, when I got to work, I was happy to be entering a heated building, but as I walked through the graveyard of elms, it wasn't a happy sight, you know. I've been through this before. When we had the hurricane a number of years ago, we had no electricity for 2 weeks. So that was 2 weeks in October, but very cold, just like this. And you know, when you get up in the morning and you know, if you're used to having a heated house, it's kind of a shock to get up and you get out of bed and suddenly it's 40 degrees in your bedroom, and then you go downstairs and it's 40 degrees in your living room, and so on. And it's not just unpleasant physically. You know, there's an immediate sense of, like, discomfort, right? But it's also unpleasant psychologically. I mean, we associate our homes with light and warmth. And so, you know, when you have your power go out and you have no heat and no light, you know, you get up in the dark and you go downstairs, it's not a happy house. It's not a home, right? It doesn't say home. You know, this has been going on for a number of days. It's definitely the case that the last morning, this morning, was not as bad as the first morning, a Saturday morning a week ago. You know, that was really a shocker. And it's definitely the case that, even though people in my neighborhood were feeling sorry for themselves, eventually, you know, if this were to go on a long time, people would think nothing of it. I'm sure you know that in places like India and Israel and much of the Mediterranean, you know, people don't have heaters in their homes. And when the temperature descends to the 40s or even to the 30s, you know, people just dress warmly. They wear sweaters and they drink hot drinks, a lot of hot drinks. Hopefully they have electricity, so that's nice. But you could get used to it, but still it was kind of a shock to me. You know, it was a shock to get up and it was 37 degrees or something in my bedroom. I started to think about how most of humanity has lived this way for thousands and thousands of years. You know, we see pictures of happy Tibetan monks. It might be they're all in their robes and they're all smiling, but you know that monastery might be 25 degrees, you know? So how come they're all smiling? And that's also true for Japan, you know? I didn't do training in Japan, but my teachers did. And I know for a fact that in Japanese temples, you know, basically there's no central heating. So when it's 37 or 27 outside, it's 27 inside. And you know, as you know, the Japanese build traditional Japanese homes are built out of wood and rice paper screens. Modern Japanese homes have insulation and everything, but the Japanese temples are, you know, basically hundreds of years old, and they have that very primitive, you could say, technology. You know, they don't heat the temples. And we had something similar in our temple. We had a temple outside of Washington that we were building, and it was called Tokuganji. And we all worked on it. We built it over a number of years. And we couldn't. We never finished insulating it for a long time. And so we would have three sesshins a year up there, and we would have our spring, summer, and fall sesshin. And fall sesshin was really, it was very challenging, because we were sitting in a zendo that had no heat, and you'd go back to a bunkhouse that had no heat, you know, and we all had our super good sleeping bags in there. But it was a challenge to sit in that cold. And I remember I would sit down on my cushion and just start shaking. You know, I would just be shaking and shaking and shaking, and trying to get my attention focused on my breath. And next to me, one of my good friends was a man named, his name is Eshin Godfrey. Eshin Godfrey. And Eshin is now the head of the Vancouver Zen Center. But in those days, we were practicing together with Genki Roshi, and I would just sit there and shake like a leaf, and I would look over at Eshin, and he would be absolutely still, like a mountain sitting on his cushion. And I would think, how does he do that? You know. Eventually, I realized, you know, when you enter deep samadhi, you know, you stop shaking. You know, when you enter deep samadhi, you definitely do stop shaking. And I got the hang of this, you know. I would get into deep samadhi, and my shaking would stop. And then, you know, when I would come out, I would start shaking again, you know. There's something so elemental or crude about having to deal with the cold like this, you know. It's easy to read a book where it says, you know, everything, it's all one, all is one, right? It's easy to look in a magazine at pictures, or online at pictures of happy Tibetan monks or Japanese or Chinese monks in their temple. And because photographs don't give you a temperature indication, you know, we don't really know what it's like to be that monk in that room at that time. But we do know one thing, that, you know, Chinese temples in the Tang Dynasty weren't heated either, you know. So, you know, there's something about heat and cold which really cut through a lot of our idealization of our experience. You know, it's possible to say, as I did, you know, I'm a pretty advanced student of Zen, and then, you know, start doing fall sesshin at Tokuganji, and, you know, the first little bit of cold, you know, had me shaking like a leaf. And that happens also, you know, in the heat. You know, we do our sesshin in August at Murray Grove, and it can be pretty hot. You know, this too is something that our Dharma ancestors had to deal with. You know, to my knowledge, there is no record of a temple in China or Japan or India that said, we're closing, it's too hot today, no sesshin. And the same thing in the cold. You know, people in ancient times wanted to follow the Great Way, and they didn't have a lot of money, and they sat down on their cushions and they practiced, and they ate rice and maybe a couple of vegetables. And it was very cold in the winter and very hot in the summer. And they didn't let that deter them. It's not just about being tough or about being hard on yourself, however. You know, this is a very deep teaching. It's like the pain in your legs. You know, people read all kinds of books on Zen, and you can listen online to many so-called spiritual teachers. You know, and sitting in your chair, you can feel like, yes, you know, all is one. But then, you know, you sit down on the cushion, and after a very short period of time, after 25 minutes or 30 minutes, your legs start to hurt. And one says, you know, what happened to my beautiful oneness? You know, suddenly I have this pain in my legs that I don't like. Or, you know, if you're sitting in a temple in China or Japan that's not heated, you know, it's easy to say everything is one, but when you feel that piercing cold, right, it just pierces you. You know, it's like, let me out of here. And when you feel that crushing heat, you know, you just want to go to a cool place and flip on the AC, right? It's not about being tough. It's about facing our limitations. You know, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. Now, I myself have preferences. So, you know, I actually like to work in my study. I like my, you know, when I'm writing on my computer or grading papers, I like the room to be warm. I definitely do. I definitely, when it's very hot, I like to be at least in a, I don't use air conditioning, but I at least like to have a cool place to do my work, right? So, you know, I too have preferences, but when we experience something that's unpleasant in this kind of visceral, crude, visceral way, it's a wonderful opportunity to get beyond our sort of like idealization of our experience and enter a deeper state of consciousness, deeper state of consciousness. So, a monk said to Tozan, heat and cold descend upon us. You know, they descend upon us. PS and ENG can't always get the heat to work. How can we avoid heat and cold? And Tozan says, well, you know, of course you could start a fire in the fireplace and that would get rid of the cold. Or you know, you could go in a hot summer day, you could go to the beach and you could sit in the cold water, cool water of a lake or of the shore, and you would cool off. That was problem solved. But you would kind of miss an opportunity. You would miss an opportunity to cut through one's idealization and really experience oneness, real oneness. It's definitely the case that nobody I know likes to be really cold. You know, penetrating cold is not very enjoyable. But sitting in the penetrating cold is a really wonderful opportunity to deepen your practice, you know. When you try to sit in the cold, you know, every breath brings you back to the cold. There's really no escaping. You breathe out and then you breathe in, and when you breathe in you feel the cold, and then you breathe out, and then it's just like pain in your legs. There's something crude and elemental about this experience. Same thing with heat. You know, when you're sitting, when it's August and you're covered with sweat and you're watching your breath, it's like you watch breath, heat, breath, heat, breath, heat. You know, so unpleasant. In that moment, you know, it's possible to go through a kind of consciousness change, consciousness transformation. And this also happens to people around day three of Sesshin. You know, around day three of Sesshin, people, your legs hurt, you're tired, you sit down on the cushion, and every breath brings you back to your pain. Every breath brings you back to your fatigue. And one says, you know, you say to yourself, I hate this, and I can't take any more, right? Around day three of Sesshin, it's like somebody switches on a light in your head, and the light comes on, and everything is different. You know, you walk around outside, and you feel everything as part of yourself. This is really a wonderful experience. And it comes from sort of confronting the boundaries that we draw around ourselves. The boundaries, you know, that we draw around ourselves. We all create a kind of self-image which is based on these boundaries. We say, you know, oh, I'm just not, I don't like to do X. You know, I don't like to do Y. You know, I'm just not the kind of person who would do that. You know, or, you know, that just, I wouldn't go there. You know, we all do that. You know, we all work out a lifestyle, a routine, which is not, you know, where we rule out certain things, and we say to ourselves, if I tried to do that, I couldn't do it. It would just be too much. But you know, what happens sometimes when you work on that boundary is that you transform yourself and your world gets bigger. You know, in yoga, this is a principle of yoga. You know, if you start doing yoga and you stretch too much, you can really hurt your muscles. And this is true in Zen too. You know, if you're a beginner in Zen and you take your cushion outside and it's 27 degrees, that might be the only sit you ever do in your life. But you know, in yoga, if you start doing some asanas and you reach a point where you say, okay, I can't safely stretch beyond this point. And that's fine. You know, you go to your place where you're not going to hurt yourself. It's the place where you're reaching a limit, and then you back off. You stop going through that motion, right? But each time you do that, you go just a little incrementally, a little farther, until you're very flexible. Well, meditation is the same thing. You know, at first you think, okay, 20 minutes is the most I could meditate. You know, and after 20 minutes, it might be the case that you're exhausted, you can't focus anymore. We had a member long ago, who when he started sitting, the most he could do was 5 minutes. I used to do a beginner's. We have a beginner's night on Monday and Friday, but we used to have a beginner's night. And people would come in, and it would be after 10 minutes of meditation, that would be it. You know, like, thank you, this was great, you know. And this guy would do 10 minutes of meditation, he was at his limit. He'd say, that's as much as I can do right now. But, you know, eventually, he would sit for an hour and a half very easily. He lives in California now, but he would sit through whole sesshins, and just, he wouldn't move a muscle the whole sesshin. And it's because, you know, he worked the boundary. You get to a place where you think, okay, I can barely get through 25 minutes of sitting. And indeed, after 25 minutes of sitting, you can't focus. Your mind is bouncing around like a ping pong ball, and all you can think about is the discomfort in your legs. But, you know, if you keep practicing, you work that boundary. You know, then you do 20 minutes this time, 25 minutes next time. Eventually, you know, getting through 35 minutes is not impossible. And pretty soon it's possible. In fact, it's easy. And then you think, well, you know, maybe I'll try the Wednesday sit. And you don't get up and do the walking. You just stay in place for 25 minutes, and then you adjust your posture, and then you do another 25 minutes, and so on. And eventually you think, I'm not going to adjust my posture. I don't have to adjust my posture. I'm just going to keep going. And then you do an hour. And then you adjust your posture. You know. And then eventually you do an hour and a half. And it's not just about being able to do an hour and a half of meditation. You know, as you're going through this process, your consciousness is changing. You know, your consciousness is changing. You know, the great Dogen said, to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with all things. So, you know, when you sit through your limitation, something happens to you. It just does. It's like you enter an altered state of consciousness. The self, which is normally at the center of our attention, moves off to the side. And there is a sort of an abiding awareness without ego. It doesn't last the whole 30 minutes, but you have moments where consciousness is no longer anchored in the self. It's just consciousness. So you watch the breath, you watch the breath, you watch the breath, and it's true. Then you think about yourself and you say, hey, I'm watching the breath, this is all going well. But then you go back to the breath and self-consciousness fades away again. This is forgetting the self. So, you know, when you get to your limit and you say, that's as much as I can do, 20 minutes, that's it for me. You know, and then you go beyond that limit, it's challenging, right? There is like your fight or flight reflex is saying, uncross your legs, uncross your legs. And if you don't do it, it's like you drop down into a deeper place. It's a drop down into a deeper place. That is, our word for that in Zen is samadhi. Samadhi. When we say samadhi, we really mean a particular kind of concentration which is not tied to the self, and which is basically, you can feel it as a kind of emptiness or a kind of, different people experience samadhi in different ways, but when you get to the boundary and then you cross it, you will often find that self-consciousness disappears and your mind becomes empty or blank. And you feel like you've gone deeply into something. You know, that feeling is a distinctive feeling of samadhi. You know, some people experience samadhi as feeling as though their body is disappearing. So my teacher, Genki Roshi, told me that when he would sit on a cushion, he felt like a stick of incense, and he would feel himself disappearing from the top of his head down to the bottom of his body. And when it got to the bottom, he was just empty. He felt empty. When I heard that, I had only been sitting for a couple of years. I thought, oh, that is so cool. You know, and I tried to visualize myself as a stick of incense, and it's never worked after 40 years. But, you know, that's because we all experience samadhi a little differently. You know, I guess if I were to describe how I experience samadhi, I would say it's like diving into the deep end of a pool. You know, if you've ever been in a diving pool and you go into the deep end and you get to the bottom of the pool, there's all this pressure from all that water pressure on you. That's kind of how I feel when I'm in deep samadhi. But my second teacher, Webb Roshi, says that when he is in deep samadhi, he feels like spider web blowing in the wind. So these are all different. We are all different, and we all experience samadhi in different ways. But what's characteristic of all of these is that the self is not present for intervals. And when you enter deep samadhi and then you begin to experience the world around you without the barrier of the self in the way, everything has this extraordinary liveliness or connectedness. And you might not feel it as connectedness, but it is connectedness. So, you know, when you, if you've been to Sesshin, and you've done a lot of sitting, around day three, you go outside, and suddenly it's like, all, you know, when you get there day one, you see flowers, but it's like, yeah, flowers, right? But on day three of Sesshin, you look at the flowers, and you feel like you are the flowers, right? And that's not an illusion from the Buddhist standpoint. That's a deeper state of awareness, connected awareness. But how to get from flowers, which is a very self-centered way of perceiving the world, to being one with the flower, that's the issue. And the method is, when it's hot, let the heat kill you. When it's cold, let the cold kill you. And please don't ever do any harm to yourself. You know, the way of, you know, our bodies are great opportunities to be. The Buddha said, to be born as a human being is extremely rare. He said that if you let's say that you are a you're a farmer and you have a yoke that you put around your plow horse. If you know what a plow horse is, a plow horse pulls a plow, and a yoke is the collar that goes around the horse. And they're also like buffalo, water buffalo collars also in East Asia. Let's say it's worn out and you throw it away and somebody takes it to the edge of the ocean and throws it in the ocean and it floats out this horse collar into the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And a turtle is swimming through the ocean and it just happens to come up through the horse collar and peek around at the sky. The Buddha said it is that rare to be born as a human being. So what are the chances? And he meant that it's incredibly precious to be born as a human and to be capable of enlightenment. So Zen, please don't ever think that Zen is about doing yourself harm or inflicting pain on yourself. That's a terrible misunderstanding. That's not what the Roshi means in this koan. You know, it's not about sitting till your teeth chatter, you know. It's about working the edge, working your boundary. And you work the boundary in a kind of careful, attentive way. Don't compare yourselves to other people. It's not a competition, right? You know, so it's not who can sit the longest or anything like that. It's the practice is to work the boundary. So, you know, if you can get through 20 minutes, congratulations. You should feel wonderful about that. And probably at the end of the 20 minutes, your mind is in a little deeper samadhi than when you sat down. And then, you know, one day you don't take the break and you sit through an hour of sitting. And maybe in the last couple of minutes, you know, it's challenging. You really have to focus on the breath. But eventually what will happen is that your body sensations take on a different character. And, you know, and they become less urgent or they become somewhat remote, you know. And when you're in that state, that's a sign you're in a very, very deep samadhi. Now, you know, humans have limited mental resources, it's true. So, you know, for most of us, after maintaining that level of concentration for an hour, we need a break. You know, most people need a break. So, you know, if you do something like that towards the end of the hour, you may feel like you need to come up for air, so to speak. you know, stretching yourself like that is really the essence of Zen practice. You know, and people don't understand this. You know, many people think of meditation practice simply as a kind of mental calming. You know, so when you come in to sit, you sit down on the cushion, you meditate, and you get up off the cushion, and you're calmer, you're a little less stressed, problems from the day are bothering you less. And that's perfectly okay to practice that way. But if your goal is like the transformation of your consciousness, then simply practicing for stress release or just to feel a little better is probably not adequate. You know, if your goal is to transform your consciousness, you need to work on your limits. And it's as simple as adding 5 minutes to your sitting time, and event at first very difficult, and then gradually gets easier and easier because you're forgetting the self. You know, I will never forget the time I the first time I did this. I was at a sesshin, and my first sesshins were very difficult. This was not easy for me, and I was in a lot of pain for a number of sesshins. And then I just kept at it. You know, I was sat regularly, and I would sort of like work the boundary. I would try to sit a little longer when I would sit, and I remember being at a sesshin, And I would always look over and see Genki Roshi and Web Sensei, at that time Web Sensei, and they would just never move. They would sit down and they wouldn't move. And I thought, how do they do that? And so, you know, I actually, at the end of a first sitting period, I just thought, I'm going to give this a try. And I watched my breath like a hawk, right? I just kept focusing on the breath, focusing on the breath, focusing on the breath. And it was like walking, I felt like I was walking a tightrope, you know? If you're on a tightrope and you fall off the rope, you know, you go crashing down. And I didn't want to go crashing down into pain, basically, physical discomfort. You know, so I just took one breath after another, like one step on a high wire. And, you know, about halfway through, I realized, you know, I really feel, I'm in a really deep place. This really feels different, you know, deep samadhi. I'm at the bottom of a diving pool, and there's all this pressure of this water on me. And I feel different. No self-consciousness, right? And then I just kept going, and you know, by the time I got to the end of the wire, the bell rang, and it was like, I can't believe I did that. How did I do that? To practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with all things. So Zen is not about punishing yourself. It's not about mortification of the flesh, right? This is a Western religious idea that has no, makes no sense in a Buddhist context. From the Buddhist point of view, it is not, the body is not flesh. See, that's a Western view. Westerners have a body hating mentality that goes back to the ancient Greeks. But for people in India and East Asia, they have never had that attitude towards the body. You know, when Confucius was dying, he showed his disciples his hands, and he said, look, I don't have any scars on my hands. I've taken such good care of my body. What he meant was, this body is a gift from my parents, and I have guarded it well. And Buddhists have the same attitude. This body is a machine for awakening, you could say. And we treat it as such. This body, Hakuin used to say, this very body is the body of the Buddha. You know, without a body, you can't wake up. Your body is the Buddha's body in that sense. So it's precious, this precious body, see. So you're not trying to punish yourself or, you know, you will routinely meet people. You know, I go to a gym and you will definitely meet people who like to punish themselves at the gym, you know. And that I don't think that's a good philosophy, right? Where you can see somebody really, you know, his face is contorted, and so it's like, I don't think I'll do that, you know. I enjoy going to the gym. It's actually a lot of fun for me, and I'm very consistent, and I am covered with perspiration when I leave, so I'm definitely doing something. But it's very important to be vigilant not to be in a self-punishing mode. Having said that, not much can be accomplished in Buddhism if you don't work the boundary. So you know, the purpose of sitting practice is not just to get comfortable and relaxed. It's to get to the place where you're not going to be comfortable and relaxed, and just going over that boundary is like another 5 minutes. And it's the same thing. Well, it's the same thing with getting up in the morning in a freezing cold house. You know, nobody likes that. If you do it long enough, though, it's not even that you stop hating it. It's that you start loving it. You start loving it. You know, I've definitely had that experience a number of times. You know, when I was when I came here to New Jersey from Seattle, I had the opportunity to practice with a teacher in New York State, up in the Catskill Mountains. And that place is near a town called Livingston Manor. And if you ever look at the temperatures, Livingston Manor seems to be the coldest place in New York State sometimes. So, you know, when it's like 20 degrees here in New Jersey, it's 4 degrees in Livingston Manor. I did quite a few sesshin, even though I had finished my formal training, I did quite a few sesshin up there, and one of the ceremonies they did, they actually had a graveyard for former members of their sangha, and they had a ceremony where they would basically honor these people, and we would go out to the graveyard. It was around the middle of the sesshin, as I recall, and we would go up on this mount. It was on a mountainside, a hill. And we would recite sutras. And I remember going out there in my robes and thinking, oh, this is going to be awful. And it was like day three or four of sesshin, though. I definitely felt I was in deep samadhi. I'd been sitting in the morning, and I went out, and it was like magic. It was like, oh my gosh, you know, this is really wonderful. I had let the cold kill me. Now I would have to do a lot of sitting to duplicate that experience, you know, because I live in a heated house just like everybody else. But it was a wonderful, wonderful experience to become one with the cold, and not to be afraid of the cold. I became one with the cold, and it was literally one of the coolest things that that's happened to me in Zen practice, because I like everybody else, you know, cold is something nobody likes, and suddenly I felt completely liberated, I did this every day for the whole sesshin, and it was wonderful every time. And I've had similar experiences in August when we have our sesshin. You know, some sesshins are quite tolerable, but, you know, occasionally we'll be in a heat spell, and the zendo can be pretty hot. And the same thing, you say, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, and then all of a sudden, you forget the self. And it's like the whole world opens up, and it's just like, I am so happy to be alive. I am so happy to be here sweating like a pig. You know, I am so happy. The flowers are so beautiful. The hummingbirds outside are so wonderful. And that's a kind of liberation. It's not kensho, but it's a kind of kensho, right? The boundary between myself and the world has dropped away, and my fear has dropped away. See, and it's really fear that holds us back. You know, there's something elemental about cold, something elemental about heat, our fear. It's like, oh, I don't think I could do that. But suddenly, you know, you do it. You cross the boundary, and the world opens up. And it's like joy, real joy. So, you know, when you see those monks in Japan, and they're sitting in an heated zendo, you might think, oh, those poor guys. And indeed, if you were transplanted there, it would be really rough. But you know, I'm sure eventually they have this experience, letting the cold kill you, letting the heat kill you. And then you come to life. See, when they kill you, you come back to life. To practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. But then, there's a third step. When you forget the self, you become one with all things, see? And then joy, real joy. The words which command the universe are obeyed throughout the ages. The spirit able to quell the tiger amazes even thousands of holy ones. His words are matchless. His spirit prevails everywhere. If you want to go through with your advanced training, you must enter the great master's forge. Forge is like the furnace, basically. The furnace. You're like iron going into the furnace. So, when you sit for another 5 minutes, you know, you're entering the great master's forge. But, forge makes it sound like you're going to be tough as steel. So, I don't think it's flexibility. You know, we think we're brittle. We think we're breakable. We think we're limited. But when we cross the threshold, we become more flexible. Tell me, who could ever show such a spirit? Main subject. A monk said to Tozan, PSENG haven't fixed the wires to my house. How can I avoid the cold? Tozan said, why don't you go where there is no cold? See? Deep samadhi. Deep samadhi. The monk said, where is the place there is no cold? Tozan said, when you are cold, let the cold kill you. When you are hot, let the heat kill you. When you're killed, your life, everything gives you a new life. Secho's verse, a helping hand, but still a 1,000-fathom cliff. In other words, the teacher held out a helping hand to the student. He said, let it kill you. But so the student might not yet understand, even though. Sho and hen, no arbitrary distinction here. Sho means real, and hen means apparent, the real and the apparent. No arbitrary distinction here. The ancient emerald palace shines in the bright moonlight. Clever Conro climbs the steps and finds it empty. It's empty of self. So, thank you so much for coming to practice.